In the coming months, Manchester resident Beatrice Munyenyezi goes on trial on charges she lied about her involvement in the Rwandan genocide to come to the United States and obtain U.S. citizenship. If that sounds familiar, that's because Beatrice Munyenyezi was on trial earlier this year on the same charges, but the jury couldn't agree on a verdict and the judge declared a mistrial. Here with more on the case is Tom Haynes. He teaches journalism at the University of New Hampshire. He recently wrote a feature on the Munyenyezi case for the Boston Globe. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brady. Happy to be here.
Prosecutors are retrying Beatrice Munyenyezi, but their case may not be the same in this new trial as it was in the first. So what may be different here?
Well, that's unknown, and to the extent that it is known, it's just sort of been what has been filed in court documents. But prosecutors have notified defense attorneys that investigators have been back to Rwanda since the first trial and have apparently found new witnesses also against Beatrice, and that those new witnesses may testify.
One of the issues that came up in the first trial with some of these witnesses from other countries was translation, interpretation. You'd expect that there would be some difficulty when witnesses speak other languages or don't necessarily speak English fluently, but why was this such a particularly big problem in the first trial?
Well, I think for two reasons. One is, as you mentioned, you know, there just inherently are always some differences. And the dynamic in the courtroom here is that you've got English-speaking attorneys questioning witnesses who've come from Rwanda, and they're speaking in their native language of Kinyarwandan. And there is an interpreter who's marshaling that back and forth, translating the words. So there's always just room for confusion there. But the second layer to this is that a lot of times the questioning of the witnesses is referencing testimony they had given elsewhere, or at least interviews they had given elsewhere. That testimony maybe has been already translated into English by someone else. And so in some situations during the first trial, you know, a witness would say, well, I didn't say that. And the question is, well, did they not say the content of the point, or were they challenging the translation of the words? There were just a couple layers to that confusion.
When Beatrice Munyenyezi first came to the U.S. and to New Hampshire, there was apparently no indication that she had done anything wrong. In fact, she was on this station in 2005 talking about leaving Rwanda and coming to the United States. Prosecutors say that's because she lied about her past and the past of some of her family members who have also faced some charges. The defense says no one here and no one in Rwanda made any kind of accusation against her until about 2008. And that seems to be when the investigation really got underway in this country. Can you tell us about that investigation with an agent from Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
You know, and what I know comes from the court testimony, but during the trial, the investigating agent testified that, you know, that the U.S. government had received information that three people may have violated U.S. immigration laws, and it's sort of obviously Beatrice would be one of those people. You know, who brought that information or why, as far as I know, is not publicly known, but that began the investigation. And so at that point, Immigration and Customs Enforcement did what they do, which is to begin to look into it.
You said that at the heart of this case are these events that took place in Rwanda more than 15 years ago. But at the same time, another complicating factor in this trial is the current political situation in Rwanda. Now, how would that play a role in this trial here in the United States?
I mean, anytime there's an event as tragic and as sweeping as a genocide in a country, it has a long impact. I suppose many observers of Rwanda would say that it still is obviously a very politically charged issue, and that the investigation of cases can sometimes be clouded by that. I talked to and quoted in my story a researcher with Human Rights Watch who said, you know, it just can sometimes be difficult to separate the pursuit of justice for genocide crimes against those for political ends. And in this case, you know, Beatrice Munyenyezi's attorneys sort of argued to the jury that that was what was at play here, that you can't trust the words of individuals anymore because they might be motivated by political pressure to accuse someone of something.
And in that case, who would the defense say are the political forces targeting the Munyenyezis?
Well, I think one piece that I wrote a lot about in my story that is just a big fact of life for Beatrice Munyenyezi is that her husband, a man named Arsène Shalom Tahobali, was convicted at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda for genocide crimes. He was accused and convicted of being a major militia leader in the town of Busari and having committed murder and committed rape. And his mother, who is Beatrice's mother-in-law, was also convicted, both a part of what became known as the Butare Six. So very high-profile perpetrators of the genocide. So in some ways, in the context of Rwandan politics, Beatrice Munyenyezi is not just any other woman. She's someone who is the wife of a very notorious perpetrator of the genocide. Additionally, her brother, who is a resident of Massachusetts and has been in the United States since 1994, has been a critic of the current administration, and he maintains that perhaps she is being targeted because of his actions, that the Rwandan government can't really accuse him of anything because he's been in the United States, but that they could accuse Beatrice to get to her. So it's very complicated. And, of course, the U.S. government would say neither of those things is true, that Beatrice committed these crimes herself and she has to be held accountable.
But, as you wrote in the article, there's no guarantee that a jury will be able to reach the verdict. In fact, you said, quote, "It is hard to imagine that a new group of 12 jurors will have any easier time than the first in determining the truth."
Well, and I think that's just the point. I'm trying to write from the perspective of a New Hampshire jury. And, you know, first of all, I could be wrong. Maybe they'll have a very easy time. We don't know what's going to come out at trial. But I think when you look at all these different aspects of translation issues and time and history and culture and then the elements of her relationships to her husband and her mother-in-law and her brother, and the different layers that they're going to be faced with, yeah, that's the question. Can they find a confirmation one way or the other?
Beatrice Munyenyezi herself did not speak at the first trial. Jurors never heard from her. But you did. You got to spend some time with her and her family in Manchester. What was that like?
Well, it was a visit in her home. She is under house arrest, so she was held in jail for 2 years after her arrest prior to the first trial, and after the mistrial, she was released to house arrest. And so I visited with her for an hour in her living room with her three daughters. She has a daughter who's a college student and two others who will be entering their senior year in high school, twin daughters. And it was effectively a casual conversation about life in the U.S., you know, we didn't talk about the charges, obviously, with the case pending, but it was interesting. And, you know, I think on a personal level, it's hard to get a feel for anyone in any situation. But what I found interesting about that moment and the reason why as a writer I wanted to meet her was to just see some other layers of her story. And in this case, to see her at home with her daughters, talking to them about their school and their studies and sharing a bit about that life, or the life that she had been living here in the States prior to her arrest in 2010. Then ultimately, as I write, there were moments in that visit when she would grow quiet and cross her arms and look down a bit and become very inwardly drawn. And, you know, to me, it was sort of a very symbolic of the question of, you know, what does she know? She knows the truth. She knows whether she did it or whether she did not. You know, that's the question that everyone else is trying to answer as well.
Tom, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Brady.
Tom Haynes teaches journalism at UNH. You can find a link to his Boston Globe feature about Beatrice Munyenyezi at nhpr.org.